Yeah, I wanted to present a model. It's a somewhat idiosyncratic model of coronal magnetic fields. So it's certainly not the mainstream perception of how coronal magnetic fields evolve, but it has some advantages. I thought it would be good for this audience. It's analytical, somewhat elegant. Also, it does touch on a lot of the ideas that have become very important in the last 5 years in understanding coronal magnetic fields, so it's not totally out in left field. Also, I began developing this theory. It's mostly what I'm going to show here is work I've been doing, and I began doing this when I was at the ITP in a program 7 years ago. I guess there was a program on plasma turbulence, and I began this model then, and it's pretty much come to fruition now, so I thought it'd be a nice time to present it or to show you how it works. I'm going to show you some data to motivate this. The idea here is going to be to understand how these complicated coronal magnetic fields, why they look the way they do and why they act the way they do. And so I want to start off with an image. Now, this isn't an image of the magnetic field, but it's an image of, here's the whole sun, imaged using an extreme ultraviolet telescope on board a spacecraft. And it actually looks at one particular wavelength due to an ion of iron that's formed primarily when the material is exactly 1,000,000 degrees. So what you're really doing is seeing only the bits of the solar corona that are at 1,000,000 degrees, and the intensity CUC has to do with the amount of density at 1,000,000 degrees. Stuff that doesn't appear white here is at a different temperature. That's all it's really saying. It could be hotter, it could be cooler. But one of the interesting things you see and so this is the whole solar disk. This is an image made by a different spacecraft at almost exactly the same wavelength. And so this is the image I want to focus on. This gives you an idea of where it appears on the solar disk. And the first thing that strikes you is how complicated and filamented this image is. And many of you are probably aware this is because that the outer atmosphere of the solar corona, of the sun, the solar corona, is structured by the magnetic field. Magnetic energy densities are believed to be 100 to 1,000 times greater than the energy density of the particles there, than the energy density of the plasma. So really, if you want to understand the corona, you just have to understand the magnetic field. And because the plasma is sort of forced to be formed along the magnetic field, what you see when you look at the plasma is you see where the magnetic field lines are going. And I'll talk quite a bit more about the magnetic field lines. So this is the outer envelope of the sun. This is the regions here. You can see what you would ordinarily see as the surface of the sun. That appears very dark because it's much cooler than 1,000,000 degrees. What you see is only stuff that's above that in the corona. But in order to understand the magnetic field, one other thing we can do, one other thing they can do, the observers, is to use the circular polarization in the wings of an absorption line to calculate exactly the magnetic field strength at the surface, at the place where the magnetic field essentially goes into the corona. So there's a surface to the sun, pretty well defined, I would say, probably as well defined as anything. And the magnetic field, if it's coming outward, going from inside the sun into the corona upward, is indicated by white on this, what's known as a magnetogram. This is at the photosphere, at the surface of the sun, we see that there's magnetic field coming out in sort of well-structured, but you could sort of see a region of positive outward magnetic field lines, and a region of black is inward-directed magnetic field lines. So this is an image made at the surface, and it is the place basically where all of these magnetic field lines come out and go back in. And you can see a correspondence where there's all this positive magnetic field. There seems to be field lines coming outward. They go out in all directions. There's some negative over there, and you can see field lines that go all the way out from the positive and into the negative. There's another pair of positives and negatives, another group of magnetic field. And what's interesting about this observation is that during the course of one day, the amount of positive and the amount of negative grows substantially. The magnetic field is actually emerging into the solar, above the solar photosphere during the course of this one day. Initially, the magnetic field lines, you can see a lot of them connect between the positive and the negative of the newly emerging flux. But you can start to see in this image that there's a region where the magnetic field from the positive of one area connects down to the negative of the other. And sort of the idea I want to address through this model is how this occurs in the solar corona. And I'll show you a movie of this happening, if I can find my mouse. And you'll see that that's an interesting process when this happens. Hopefully, we'll see that. So this is a movie of that same observation. And this is the emerging magnetic region. So what we see here, this is the old magnetic region that used to be there, was always there, continues to be there. And what you can see is the new magnetic field lines coming into existence and some magnetic field lines forging new connections, connections that weren't there before this started to emerge. In plasma physics, this really is an example of an elusive phenomena that people have speculated about for 50 years, known as magnetic reconnection. And it's an idea, the idea that you can make new magnetic connections between pairs of poles and that it should release energy into the corona when it does that, is really what this model is all about.
Right, so, how do you define the surface, the difference between the interior and
the corona? The way you define it is the place that photons become free. Essentially, they're random walking on the inside of the, they're random walking on the interior. And at a point where their mean free path first diverges, that's optical depth one, in other words, yeah. And so that's, and the scale height, the sort of characteristic scale with which density increases and with which this mean free path decreases is very small on the total scale of the sun. It's a minuscule fraction. So that's a good question. But yeah, what I'm going to do then is propose a model where we think about the magnetic field that's imposed at a surface and ask ourselves, the problem really will be, and I think that's it for this data. So now we can get off. Okay. I think we'll.
You're looking at 1 million degrees. Oops. What kind of data is this again? And
it
why
is.
Does it trace the field lines? I guess that's why.
I will get to why it traces the field lines in a second. Okay, now I'm gonna go over to chalk. But what we're doing is we're using a spectral line that's only formed at that one temperature. The problem I propose to discuss is really a simple one. We're gonna give ourselves a three-dimensional coordinate system. Z is up. Z equals 0 will be this surface, the photosphere of the sun. And what I would like to know is if we observe a magnetic field, if we have a bound, it's really a boundary value problem. If I constrain the vertical component of the magnetic field on this plane, I would like to know what is the magnetic field above the plane. What is B x everywhere above the plane given this boundary data? So I'm really interested in solving a boundary value problem here. And in particular, I want to find an equilibrium magnetic field, a magnetic field that is in equilibrium. And because the magnetic energy density is so much greater than everything else, it's in equilibrium if the magnetic energy is a minimum. If I can find a magnetic field that minimizes this quantity, the energy, which is 1/2 b squared integrated over the whole volume, and because the magnetic field is divergence free, I'm going to write the magnetic field as the curl of a vector potential, and that will allow me to write the energy as, where this volume is everything above z equals 0, subject to the constraint that the vertical component of B has to match the boundary conditions. So I'm going to do a variational calculus, variational problem, where I minimize this. essentially I take A to A plus delta A, integrate by parts, I get the variation in the magnetic energy is curl of A, dotted into delta A. And in order for this to be a minimum, the variation must vanish under all perturbations delta A. Subject, I threw away the surface term because delta A vanishes, or at least its parallel components vanish on the surface. What I'm left with then is that this term here must vanish everywhere, which is another way of saying curl of B must equal zero. And that makes the magnetic energy a minimum. Not very surprising. If curl of B is equal to zero, I actually could have written B instead of as a curl of something. I could have written it as the gradient of a scalar potential. So this is called a potential magnetic field. And of course, it has to be divergence-free, which means the potential must be harmonic. And given my boundary conditions, it must satisfy d chi dz at z equals 0 is equal to minus f. And we have Laplace's equation with a Neumann condition. There's a unique solution for given boundary data. And therefore, there's a unique potential magnetic field that minimizes the magnetic energy subject to boundary data. Now.
And the current then is 0.
And the current is zero. Curl of B is the current. Now, this isn't the whole story, because the coronal magnetic field, the corona is actually filled with hot plasma. And this gets to your question about why we see the magnetic fields. Because it's a hot plasma, it's actually a conductor. It's a good conductor, or a super good conductor. Not a superconductor. It doesn't have any Meissner effect. There's no Cooper pairs. But it's just a really good conductor, which means the electric field is equal to zero inside a conductor. Or it's actually a fluid, so it's moving around. So I have to be careful when I write this down. This is the electric field in the reference frame of the conductor, which, since I don't really know much about relativity, I will use a Galilean transformation to put myself in the reference frame of the fluid element and write down the transformed electric field, which is actually the electric field plus 1 over C V cross B. And this must equal 0 because we have a good conductor here. If I use the Coulomb gauge, I can actually write this as is equal to V cross B. Actually, I'll write that over here so we remember it. So this is an equation that governs the evolution of the magnetic field if I know the way the plasma moves around. And it governs it because the plasma is a very good conductor. And actually, what this ultimately tells us is that if I have a magnetic field at one time, and if I form integral curves of that magnetic field, sorry about this, there are a couple of equations I want to keep on the board here, which are field lines. A field line is a solution of this ordinary differential equation. The tangent of the curve R of S, a field line, is a curve R of S parameterized by some parameter S that satisfies this differential equation. So at any instant, I can trace out from an initial point somewhere, I can trace out all a magnetic field line, trace out magnetic field line going forwards and backwards in S. And the important property of this field line is if I have two blobs of plasma that happen to lie on the same field line at some time t. Okay, so I integrate this ordinary differential equation from, say, my plasma blob number 1, and I follow it forward, and I find that there's some other plasma blob number 2 that lies on the same field line. Then at any later time, those two plasma blobs have to lie on the same field line. In a sense, that means field lines are real. In a lot of well-meaning but misguided elementary physics courses, they tell you these lines of force are fictitious. They're not real things. And that's because you are not a good conductor. If you're a good conductor, these are extremely real things. If you two share the same field line now, you always will and you always have. So, and the reason to show this doesn't require that much algebra. You use this equation here. You also use an equation for the evolution of points in space, which is namely that the velocity itself gives you the time derivative. And you basically need to find the commutator between d by dt and d by ds, and you use the curl of this equation, which tells you how the two vector fields essentially relate to one another in space and time. Because of that, because of this, and this equation here, which follows from it being a good conductor, we now have the idea that the magnetic field lines are real material lines that cannot do anything a material line can't do. Namely, they can't be broken. I can't actually imagine having these two lie on the same magnetic field line at one time and then at a later time not be on the same field line.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So the time-independent problem, the problem you solve for the magnetic field, which is minimized.
Right. That's right.
And now suddenly this field is time-dependent.
Yes, it is.
Why?
Why? Because I'm about to pose a new problem. I'm about to put a constraint on this minimization. And the constraint involves the time dependence of the plasma. Namely, can it, through any series of motions, get from one state to another state? And it doesn't have to be real time, but it has to be some sequence of evolutionary states that obey this frozen in field law. So that's a good question. Sorry, I didn't foreshadow this. But this tells you that at any given time there is a minimum energy magnetic field, but it doesn't tell you whether you can get there through any sequence of motions. So I'm going to actually propose two new variational problems. The first is going to be a well-known version of the variational problem. The second will be my new wrinkle on it. Now, the well-known version is going to say, if I have a coronal magnetic field and I trace the field lines, there are two foot points, places at z equals 0, where the magnetic field leaves the photosphere and where it goes back into the photosphere. I'm going to say, I'm going to minimize the magnetic energy by varying all the paths of all the different magnetic field lines, but not allowing any of them to break. And I'm going to hold them anchored at each of their foot points. So that means no displacement can occur at z equals 0. And up here, the magnetic field must undergo some time variation that looks like this. Or if I integrate this, I'll actually say delta A is equal to a displacement field delta C crossed with B. That's just time integrating this and saying that the velocity is an infinitesimal displacement per unit time. So now I actually find out that the variation in the vector potential is not arbitrary if I believe this frozen in field law. And therefore, I should plug into this equation the fact that I can't vary over all delta A's. So it's a constrained variational problem. And I'll just rewrite this as curl of B dotted into delta C cross B. B cubed X is equal to 0. Or triple product rule, I can say B cross curl of B dotted into delta C is equal to 0. And this must vanish not for every variation delta A, but for every displacement of the plasma delta C, which vanishes at the surface. And it gives me a different equation for the equilibrium magnetic field. Namely that curl of B crossed with B must equal 0. So what I did was I started with an energy, and I proposed to vary that energy. And I found that I get a potential magnetic field, which is the minimum possible energy state. But if I applied a constraint, I got an equation that is satisfied by the potential magnetic field. But there are many magnetic fields that are not potential that satisfy this. In fact, it's a nonlinear equation. And solving it is extremely difficult. OK, and this is known as a force-free field, because J cross B is the force-free field. Not necessarily.
We're going to do it
quasi-static as a series of equilibria. But first I want to know, for instance, how all the different solutions to this equation, which I couldn't tell you. So I'm going to propose a third type of variational constraint.
Are you assuming the time scale for emergence is much longer than...
Yes. The movie we saw there was 2 days. The time it takes dynamically to react to anything is of order 10 to 30 seconds. So it's a fairly slow process. And if we just map out a sequence of equilibria, which takes us from one boundary condition to another, we'll actually get to something very close to how the magnetic field behaves. Okay, the force-free field followed from imposing boundary conditions at every foot point, basically saying every foot point has to remain fixed where it is. And the new kind of constraint, the third way I'm going to do this variational problem, is going to assume the following. I'm going to assume that my boundary data consists of a finite number of regions at which f is not equal to 0. Between these regions, these source regions, f is equal to 0 exactly, and then there's just a finite countable set of discrete regions known as source regions. We could call this P1, the magnetic field that only leaves P1. This is P2, magnetic field leaves P2. This is N3, say, a region where the magnetic flux is into the page. And I am going to, now if I make this assumption about the boundary data, it then follows that all the magnetic field lines in the corona have to go from a positive to a negative source. And I can essentially break the coronal volume, I can divide it up into domains. And a domain is defined, domain ij is defined as, well, it's the set of all field lines that if you go one way, you get to pi. If you go the other way, you get to nj. So it's a set of all field lines that couple. So this is one field line from domain 2, 3. There's another field line from domain 2, 3. There's, in fact, a whole volume of field lines that go from p2 to n3. There's actually, I can calculate psi ij, which is equal to the flux, the total amount of flux that crosses any surface where, you know, every field line crosses that surface once and only once. So I can put a surface down here and essentially calculate the number of field lines in domain ij. That's the flux psi ij. So I have a set of domains that define my corona and a set of fluxes, one flux for each domain. I'm going to propose a constraint that really amounts to the following. I'm going to allow foot points to move within their sources to minimize the magnetic energy. I'm going to look for a minimum magnetic energy, allowing the foot points to move, but only within their own source. This is equivalent to minimizing the magnetic energy subject to a constraint on all of the domain fluxes. If there are seven, I'll show you an example where there are seven different ways positives and negatives are connected. So there are seven different fluxes. I'm going to do this variation in such a way that I constrain seven fluxes and ask what is the magnetic field that arises from that variational problem. It's actually a subset of the constraints imposed by here. Right? This is a superset. This is basically the most restrictive set of constraints I could have applied was to anchor everyone's foot points. Here I'm saying the foot points are allowed to move, but only within their own region, and they can't jump across. So I'll get an equilibrium that's intermediate between the force-free equilibrium and the potential magnetic field equilibrium. In fact, what I'm going to get is very interesting. The curl of the magnetic field, the currents in every domain will vanish. The magnetic field will be a potential magnetic field within each domain. And there will be a subset of interfaces between domains, regions where the domains come into contact, where we'll get surface currents. It's a very small subset of a certain number of these defects in the magnetic field. That's the answer.
Excuse me. So,
yeah.
I mean, is this sort of supposed to be a good model for the sun?
It's.
Is this what happens?
Yeah, it's a good model. We certainly see as you saw in that movie, as you saw in two stills, that the photospheric magnetic field does change. The photospheric magnetic field is actually anchored. The reason we see it cross into the corona is because it comes from inside the sun. How these magnetic field lines within these domains move around is really not easy to understand. But it is pretty easy to understand that magnetic field, because of the frozen influx theorem. Magnetic field lines can't jump across from one place to another. Or they can if somehow in one place the corona became a really lousy conductor. And why would it become a really lousy conductor? Just based on temperature, it's a very good conductor. It turns out the kinds of defects we get here are something that would trigger an instability that would reduce the conductivity, increase the resistivity of the plasma. So therefore, it sort of gives you this picture of how energy could be stored through a finite set of constraints and then released through a transition to a poor conductivity. Yeah.
So every dynamic stems from the change of your energy from your boundary.
Right. If I have time at the end, I just want to get to a quasi-static picture of dynamics in which we slowly change the locations of these elements.
Yeah,
and therefore,
there's no theory, no dynamic goes for the dynamics of these boundary conditions, right?
No. They're fixed boundary conditions. In fact, the tough part is going to be to do this variational problem for fixed boundary conditions. You might even ask yourself, I just said here we're going to have, a certain number of constraints, but how am I going to mathematically phrase those constraints? And how many actually are there? And let me draw a cartoon here that will allow us to sort of picture. Well, the number of constraints I actually have is going to depend on the number of domains I have. And that's going to depend on how many positive elements there are connected to how many negative elements, how many ways they're connected. And this is really to answer the question of how many different constraints I've got if I've got a certain number of domains. I need to appeal to graph theory. So I'm going to draw a schematic representation of six sources. So I'll have P1, P2, P3, and these could be, let's see, I'll add one over here. So six sources connected somewhere here. Imagine you construct the potential magnetic field and then figure out what domains are in the potential magnetic field. We'll think about it that way. In this case, N4, N5, and N6, and just say, for this example, that these are connected in the following graph. So what this tells me is of my six domains here, so that could be N4, I have some field lines that connect P1 to N5, some connect P1 to N4, some connect P1 to N6, etc. So I have six sources here, and I have seven different domains. So you might think I'm proposing seven constraints, but it's not exactly true. Because I also have boundary conditions that BZ is fixed down here. And if I constrain the boundary conditions, then say this is N6, then the total amount of flux coming out of N6 is given just from integrating the boundary conditions over N6. That tells me the total amount of flux coming out of N6. That's given by the boundary conditions. And in fact, I can see here by this graph that the flux coming into N6 can't have come from anywhere but P1. It can't. So essentially, the amount of flux in this domain, psi 1 6, must equal the amount of flux. So this I don't even need to constrain. It's given to me by the boundary conditions. Okay? So in this graph sort of gives me a handle on the fact that some of these fluxes are constrained by the boundary conditions, and I need only add additional constraints where the boundary conditions are ambiguous. And if the boundary conditions are ambiguous, it means I can change the flux of a domain and not violate the boundary condition. Well, clearly I couldn't change the flux of one domain, but if I see a circuit in this graph, and a circuit is a path, I can go start from here, go up, over, down, and come back to the same point without retracing my steps. If there's a circuit, there's an ambiguity in the domain fluxes. What I could do is I could add a little to this domain 1, 4. Well, that would actually change the boundary condition, so I better subtract the same amount from here. Add, subtract. It's a bipartite graph. It means I always have to go positive, negative, positive, negative. Therefore, I'll always come back. It'll be consistent with. So anytime there's a circuit in the graph, I have an ambiguity in the domains, domain fluxes. And I can eliminate that by placing a constraint on one domain in that loop, in that circuit. So if I constrain the flux here, flux there is already constrained. Now this flux is also fixed. And I can imagine when I place a constraint on one domain, that's like removing the edge from the graph. Okay? So I could say now psi 1, 4 is equal to some fixed psi 1. That's my constraint. Capital psi 1 is my constrained value for this. And now I think I've constrained all the fluxes. No, I've got another circuit down here. Okay? So if there's another circuit, I have to place another constraint. Psi 3, 4 is equal to capital psi 2. Every time a circuit remains, after I've removed an edge, I need another constraint. I'm not done until what I'm left with, if I imagine removing these, is a kind of graph called a tree. A tree is a graph in which there are no circuits. It's not possible if I there's a unique path between every pair of points, and the path is unique. Yeah, there's no circuit, no two ways to get between any two points. If I have a tree, the number of edges in a tree is equal to the number of vertices, which are the number of sources here, minus 1. That's just a property in graph theory of a tree. That's how many edges it has to have. So how many constraints do I need in order to reduce this to a tree? Well, the number of constraints is the number of edges I start with minus the number of edges in a tree. So for any arbitrary graph you can draw, the number of constraints you have to impose in order to do this variational problem is equal to the number of edges minus the number of vertices plus 1. Write that down. So that tells me how many constraints there are. In this problem, there are 2. So even though I have 7 edges, 7 domains, if I fix this domain and this domain, I fix them all, and now I can do my variational calculus if I can figure out how to apply the constraint mathematically. Okay. Well, I'm planning to vary the vector potential, so an easy way to do the vector, the constraint, is to do a loop integral along some, we'll call it Q2, A dot dl, where Q is some loop in space that every field line in domain 3, 4 has to go through. So here's P3, and here's N4. So there are some field lines that go from P3 to N4. I need to find a loop that every single one of those field lines has to, a hoop that it has to jump through, and that no other field lines jump through. In order to figure out where that is, I need to think about where the boundaries of these domains are. What makes the boundary of a domain? And again, I'm going to continue thinking about the potential magnetic field. So really what I'm asking, if I want to figure out a boundary, I think, well, there's a field line that connects P3 to N4, and there are field lines that connect P2 to N4. So there must be a boundary between field lines that come from P2 and field lines that come from P3. And where do those field lines come from? They can't come from P2, they can't come from P3, they can't come from any other source, or else they'd be a member of that domain. They have to come from somewhere that's not a domain. And then here's again where your undergraduate education or undergraduate teaching may sell you short, because they tell you field lines can't have beginnings or ends. And that ain't so. This equation for a field line has a singular point where the magnetic field vanishes. So if I have a place where B is equal to 0, I can actually have a whole family of field lines that begin there. And if I think about the structure of field lines around a singular point, I'm really talking about stagnation points in a divergent flow, if you want to think about this as flow rather than field lines. And if I smash 2 divergence-free flows together, they basically have a structure that looks like that in 2 dimensions. They basically all scoot off here, and here is the degenerate flow line that originates at the stagnation point. In 3 dimensions, this actually, you can picture it as having a cylindrical symmetry, although it doesn't have to. So we have either a family of field lines, a surface of field lines that all originate at the null point. That's known as a separatrix surface. This is, in that case, a positive null. In three dimensions, nulls come in two flavors, positive and negative. A positive null has a fan, a separatrix surface in which field lines all emanate from the null, and two magnetic field lines enter the null. In this case, the two magnetic field lines would come from P2 and P3, and then we'd have a fan of field lines, surface of field lines, that go out, and that forms the boundary between these two. In fact, all boundaries in this domain must come from null points. We have positive null points that have field lines. Well, I'll draw a picture of a positive null point. Field lines come in along two directions and go out along a surface, sometimes called the span, the spine, and the fan of field lines. And negative null point, which is just has the arrows reversed. Field lines come in along the spokes, along the span, fan, and go out along the spine. So if I find all of these null points and then trace all of their separatrix surfaces, that must be all the boundaries between these domains, and my magical loop Q must somehow lie on there. In fact, if I think about all the field lines coming from P3 and going to N4, here's P3 schematically, there's N4. Now all the field lines that, all the boundaries that enter N4 must come from positive nulls, positive null type B, and all the field lines entering P3 on the boundaries must come from negative nulls. And these surfaces must meet. These separatrix surfaces must intersect, and they must intersect along a field line that's simultaneously a member of a fan surface from a positive and a negative null. So I can imagine taking these two and intersecting them, and I will get one field line, in general, that connects a positive to a negative null. It's known as a separator field line. Or, since these surfaces are actually curved, they can intersect in a countable number of separators. That can actually be a loop of such field lines. Okay? These separators are the key to this whole problem. This is where the current sheets are going to form. And the reason is because there must be a loop of such separators, and this whole loop must be my surface Q, my loop Q2. This is the loop that every field line that goes from P3 to N4 must somehow go through that, it must jump through that hoop, and therefore my constraint must be phrased in terms of this separator field line, or this loop of separator field lines. Okay, this is the toughest part. Geometrically, this is the toughest part to envision. These fan surfaces melding together to form boundaries and then intersecting along field lines and getting loops of separators. And there's a bit of graph theory that Isaac Clapper helped me work through. You can really convince yourself that this is a complete set of field lines that decomposes the space the way you really think it should. Now we're back to variational calculus. I'm going to write down a constraint functional, which if it's zero, my constraints on my two domains in this case, or my NC domains, are satisfied. It's a functional of the vector potential A. It's going to be a sum over all my separators, and I'll write it, my loops, and I'll write it this way, with, of course, a Lagrange undetermined multiplier. I need a Lagrange undetermined multiplier, or I can use a Lagrange undetermined multiplier, because I'm going to do variational calculus. I have my capital Psi minus loop integral Q A dot dl. So A dot dl around that loop tells me how much flux is in the domain. That's the amount of flux my constraint tells me has to be in the domain. And then that should be zero, and I can multiply it by an undetermined multiplier, and I can do my variational calculus. And the number of terms in this is dependent on, well, it's given by this formula here. And I'm almost ready, but I focused on the topology or the geometry of potential magnetic fields, and it led me to one slightly inaccurate conclusion. If I have P2, N4, N5, P3, just imagine this in two dimensions. So I have magnetic fields. Potential field would have four domains meeting at a single point, and that point is the separator, Q2 in this case. So four domains in a potential magnetic field in two dimensions meet at a single point. If I do any kind of perturbation, for instance, I pull these away or push these two closer together, essentially imagine each of the domains as some deformable solid object, like an elastic body. This is structurally unstable. It will give rise to a configuration where, in general, the regions meet only three at a time. So you never meet, it's not stable to meet, to try to meet four domains at one point. They instead give rise in two dimensions. And this is a sort of well-known result. In two dimensions, you can do a lot of this theory with complex function analysis. This is a branch cut. But more generically, you have to allow, instead of this point, instead of the separator circuit to be a point here, it has to be a curve. In two dimensions, and I don't want to belabor this because it gets kind of nasty, in three dimensions, we actually have to allow this curve, Q sigma, to actually be an annular surface, a family of curves. This is just a family of points, all of which lie on the same point. So I'll just rewrite this because, yeah, we are running out of time here. But this is, so I'm going to replace this with a family x sub sigma of parameterized by two parameters, xi and eta. And this, okay, xi is the lengthwise parameter. So q is now annulus like this. C is the parameter that runs lengthwise. Eta is the parameter that runs spanwise. I actually then get a different Lagrange multiplier for every curve. But otherwise, minus A dot C. I think that's right. This is just the vector that points in a direction parallel to the annular surface. So this is the more honest way of imposing a constraint. There's an additional constraint that this surface has to always be tangent to the magnetic field. No magnetic fields can be normal to it. I don't want to go through that. It just adds one more function that looks exactly like this, because I want to now get down to the business of varying the magnetic energy, the magnetic field, and making the magnetic energy a minimum. So what I actually vary now is W plus the constraint C. Constraint 0, I can vary 0, and it's still 0. That is going to be curl of B dot delta A minus, and I have to do the variation of this whole thing with respect to A. You can see A just appears here linearly. So this isn't going to be very hard at all. D eta lambda sigma of eta. D x sigma dc dot delta A c is equal to 0. This is the variation. Now, what I'm going to need to do is rewrite this integral over a surface as a volume integral in order to put it on the same footing here, and then I'll just have delta A times some big thing, and that thing has to vanish. And all I need to do is appeal to some function, delta function, whose support is confined entirely to Q. So I'll just write that as delta of Q sub sigma. That's this delta function whose support is, okay. Curl of B minus the sum over all my delta functions, lambda sub sigma this is just a tangent vector, so I'll just write it t hat times delta q sub sigma, all dotted into dA, is equal to 0. So this is my Euler Lagrange, this is my variation. And of course, in order to make the variation stationary under all perturbations delta A, this whole thing has to vanish. And what it tells me is curl of B, which is the current, must be, well, this whole thing here, which is a current density confined to the surfaces defined by this parallel, and the undetermined multipliers are the surface current density. Had I included this other variation, we would have gotten another direction also tangent to the magnetic field. And so basically I could find the surface. So I could find current densities as long as they were confined to the surface. I have some arbitrary set of current densities. And everywhere else that's not on one of these annular surfaces, the magnetic field is current free. Okay, so
that currents are they within one of these regions?
Excuse me?
Are these currents going within one
of so
these regions?
What the current does, what the current does is it actually flows along an annulus. Well, the annulus is actually essentially topologically closed along the boundary. So it just extends into the corona. And this is the current, and it has to follow this ribbon. And what we then do is define the Lagrange multiplier here by reimposing our constraints. So I find the solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation, and as you expect, that's not a trivial task. This is actually a free boundary problem. We have an unknown location for this surface current, but for a given surface current, I can find a magnetic field. And if the magnetic field satisfies, first of all, the requirement that the magnetic field not cross the surface, that came from the other constraint. But more after I've done that, I will then find all of the fluxes as a function of my Lagrange multipliers, essentially, lambda and c. And now I have to set the Lagrange multipliers, or set the currents. The Lagrange multipliers are the net currents in each. They're actually the distribution of current. But if I integrate them d eta, I get the net current flowing in each one. So the net currents have to follow from satisfying this. And I also happen to know, had I set my problem up, well, okay, now we have the basic structure of this magnetic field. Let me now, I think I have enough time to do this as a quasi-static problem. So let's consider the nature of this constrained variation. Let me say I start with a distribution of boundary flux, f, x, and y. And I'm actually going to make it a fairly simple one, p1, p2, n3, and n4. That has a single separator, essentially goes like this, and it sets the amount of flux that connects P1 to N3. This is the structure of that. Now, I have a potential magnetic field corresponding to this distribution of flux. And in that, this is Psi1, capital Psi1, there is a value of that flux for the potential magnetic field. Okay, so if I start with a potential magnetic field, the amount of flux connecting P1 to N3 is determined. Now I imagine slowly changing the structure of these boundary conditions. So say I take these two and move them. Take time, draw. So I'm going to construct something that now has the following. I'm going to put them right next to each other like that. So this is N3, this is P1, this is P2, this is N4. Now the separator does something like that. So I have a new set of boundary conditions. I've imagined deforming this boundary flux quasi-statically, and I want to find a new equilibrium. But with new boundary data, I'll have a new potential magnetic field, which will have a different amount of flux through this loop. In fact, it'll probably have more, because these two sources are closer together, and so they're going to have more magnetic flux in the potential magnetic field. But if I did this under ideal conditions, then the flux connecting these two could not have changed. So I will actually get some current. And now you can sort of picture how a circuit would solve the same problem. If I actually had a superconducting wire, the flux inside of which was constrained to be fixed, even as I changed the external drivers of the magnetic field, the change in flux through here would actually induce a current whose self-flux would offset the difference. So what I'll get is actually a current flowing this way that creates a self-flux that offsets that difference. So the current is roughly going to be proportional to delta psi 1. That is where delta psi 1 is equal to minus psi 1 potential. The difference between the flux I've got and the flux the potential magnetic field wants to give me. Okay, and it goes that way if delta psi is positive, as it is in this case. Now I have to go back and try to remember why it was I was unable to change the magnetic flux through this particular loop, or the number of magnetic field lines that connect P1 to N3. And that was because of this equation here, which told me if I tried to figure out the change in psi 1, d psi 1 dt, that would equal the electric field with a minus sign, that is Lenz's law, the electric field along that loop. And the electric field along the loop was equal to 1 over C V cross B. It was always perpendicular to the magnetic field. So in fact, if this was true, if it was a good conductor, the change in flux was equal to 0. What I got instead was a very high current density concentration along this loop. And if there were any place in the corona that was going to start to behave not like a very good conductor, it would be a place where the current density is extremely high, a singularity in the magnetic field. So the picture, the sort of way this model is heading, is you imagine that at some point this breaks down, and you are able to get some electric field, some loop voltage in here, due to an anomalous resistivity. What that does is essentially eliminates a constraint from your constrained variational problem. If you eliminate a constraint, you're going to lower your energy. We solved a problem that was minimizing the magnetic energy subject to a certain number of constraints. If I solve it for a subset of those constraints, I always get a lower energy. So you will, if I break the frozen influx theorem, I will liberate a certain amount of energy. And that is the idea I propose for how you can explain, first of all, the complex nature of the magnetic fields we saw there, namely that there are certain topologically defined places where magnetic fields will become discontinuous, where currents will accumulate, and when we break the frozen influx theorem at those places, we liberate energy, which therefore gives rise to non-thermal particles and heating and energetic events like solar flares. And it all comes from solving a constrained variational problem and then having something come in and eliminate one or more of the constraints. So thank you very much. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Do you have a similar movie of simulations with this model?
I do. Yeah, I think I can find one of them. Sure. Oops. This is on. That's off. Let's see if I can. I hadn't thought to apply them because to explain them, you then get into the whole issue of when you release energy into this loop. What it ultimately does is drives the additional heat, evaporates material from up here, from down here, increases the density in here. And as I mentioned, maybe very briefly, what we're seeing when we see these EUV images of the solar corona, we're seeing the plasma, we're seeing the places where the plasma is particularly dense. So by enhancing the density, you enhance the current. And let's see here. Yes, now we're gonna find them. I didn't. Come on. Okay. And they're not in here, unfortunately. But I think I had a talk with a lot more slides that may have exactly that in it. And let's see. So I guess I can show you a couple. I think this, first of all, shows the isn't a movie, but this shows the original magnetic field that I showed you. This is a separatrix surface that encloses the domain of new flux. So this is the region where those magnetic field lines are supposed to lie. They don't do a perfect job. That's one of the things I'm working on here. I think it has to do with the fact that there is current due to other constraints, namely helicity constraints, which I didn't want to talk about. There's a three-dimensional perspective view. You do see, though, that you get some amount.
So the data is that, since the stuff is lit up, is where the current density is high?
No. What it's going to be is where the current density, where basically you've just accomplished this process of letting new flux into this domain. So there's a constraint that says the total amount of flux, the separator, I should point out, is this field line here. And so that's where the current sheet is. And essentially, in order to become new flux, your initiation rate is to go through that. And once you've gone through it, something dramatic has happened to you. Your resistivity has gone up. And let's see, I have right here a movie. Now, where is that? Movie of, okay. Yes, this is a simpler case. We had two poles, a bunch of stuff in the background. Here in blue is the separator. Here in green is the magnetic field line that's just gone through that separator. So this is the loop we expect to light up. And there is the image from Trace that shows where that would be. And the movie that David asked me for was here. And oh shoot, I thought I had that. Maybe if I, oh, okay, how do I show the movie? I think, yeah, there we go. I'm going to essentially see one of these loops just brighten up and dim, I hope. Yes. So, unfortunately, this is the state of the model right now. There's a certain amount of energy. The energy is actually predicted exactly with no free parameters by the theory. And so the amount of heat you see is somewhat consistent. Here's the amount of energy we get liberated, something on the order of 10 to the 6 times 10 to the 25 ergs. And there's the amount of temperature. It rises up. It actually rises up quite a bit higher than the 1 million degrees. So the only time you see it is when the plasma cools off down into the 1 million degree temperature band. There's probably something That scenario, while it's predicted by this theoretical model, doesn't seem to really match the observations as well as we'd like. There must be The energy release must be happening over a much longer time. Here I've had it happen over 200 seconds, which is about 10 Alphane times. One predicts these energy releases are dictated, the timescales are dictated by the Alphane transit times. In fact, it may be a much longer period of energy release, which is why it doesn't get up to 4 million degrees. But I really wish I had, you know, a model with all these many flickering loops, but that's a couple more years down the road. Maybe in 7 years after I've worked on this, seven more years, I can come back and have a full synthetic trace movie for you.
Any more questions?
Okay.